From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The White House convenes another higher education summit, the second this calendar year. And a recent Rolling Stone article about a brutal gang rape at the University of Virginia raises questions about the culture of college fraternities. Hi, I'm Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So we welcome all, and ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation today talking about the second White House Higher Education Summit. This week, the White House convened another Higher Education Summit, the second such event this calendar year. Ahead of the event, press materials cited more than 500 promises from campus leaders, state officials, and nonprofit organizations to help low-income students gain access to and complete college. The question is, was this week's convening a substantive event, or was it, as Inside Higher Ed characterized the first gathering in January, just another feel-good summit? Helping us understand the nature of the summer experience and what happened in Washington this week, joining us are Gail Mello, who is the president of LaGuardia Community College in New York, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Gail, you were not at the first summit in January, but you were at the summit this week. What's changed in 11 months that would warrant another gathering?
I think what's changed is an emerging narrative, a coherence about where all the colleges are going. I think I saw real seriousness in terms of all of our attempts to make a big difference for low-income students and students of color to really get to college and get through college.
Scott, one of the things that did not change in the context of the conversation is that while the president and the first lady seem to be giving a lot of kudos to campus leaders, Vice President Biden was there to remind them about the issue of college costs.
Yes, and I'm not sure if that was scripted, but it did add some tension to the event. And I think the reality is for a lot of the public, that would be the dominant issue. Now, it's a tricky issue, of course, because many would say that state legislatures' decisions have as much, if not more, to do with college costs than colleges' decisions. But it is an omnipresent political issue.
Gail, let me come back to you. You were not at the first event. This one seems to have been much larger, more people and more institutions, and certainly more community colleges and less elite institutions. What's your take about the shift in the attendance at the one event, at the January event versus this week's event?
If the United States is really going to move the needle on graduation up from college for low-income and minority students, we have to talk to where most students go to college, which is the big publics. And so I think that that was a recognition that it's really a system problem, and also that the, if I might loop back to the issue of funding, there was as clearly a statement from the president saying that unless states really think about funding public higher education, we also won't be able to serve these students.
Well, Scott, will the White House conference have much impact on the states? I mean, we've had this ongoing conversation about college cost, the fact that the states have reduced their funding for public institutions, and yet, you know, tuition goes up. In California, it's going to go up 5% a year at the University of California for the next several years.
I think it is part of a larger political discussion. And in states with no money, I don't think a White House event is going to, by itself, change the dynamic. But I do think there is some power of the pulpit and drawing attention to issues that might get ignored otherwise. An example I would give, Michelle Obama's speech, in which she talked about the gap in high school guidance counselors for students at wealthy and non-wealthy high schools. That's a huge issue that has a big impact on the way a lot of students understand their options, and it's generally off the radar screen. I don't know that people will act on it, but it's sort of inherently good to put an issue like that in more public attention.
Gail, I want to come back to sort of the cost of admission for the folks that were attending these events. Inside Higher Ed reported that the January event cost of admission was a commitment to do something, to make a promise that would help low-income students. That seemed to have been the same thing in terms of the event this week. I noticed that LaGuardia issued a release saying that its commit would be to increase, I believe, 680 more graduates over some period of time. I mean, how realistic are these commitments that many have made, institutions and other organizations?
I think they are realistic. I think they're really based on the kinds of new initiatives that we're doing that really combine technology with existing systems, which means it's sustainable. At LaGuardia, what we're doing with Valencia Community College and Maricopa Community College is a online professional development for faculty project. We think that if each faculty in the country could help just two more students make it through their class, we'd raise graduation rates in the country by 10%. So I think it's investment in those kinds of sustainable, doable things that combine faculty work with technology tools, what I would call teaching analytics, as well as learning analytics, that it's going to make a real big difference.
So, Scott, there were commitments made for the January conference. Is it too early to assess the impact of those initial commitments and what that might suggest about the commitments that were made for this week's conference?
For many of them, unfortunately, it is, because colleges said they were going to do more on certain things or maybe hire somebody who would help to do more. What I like about LaGuardia is, and this shows the courage of its president, is there are actual numbers attached. So we'll be able to see in a few years, is LaGuardia graduating more students annually as a result of the initiatives that President Mello described? Not everyone is attaching such specific goals to their actions. And so it is harder to track some of them than others.
Gail, what were some of the other aspects of the conference that seemed important to you as you go back to your campus and talk with your peers and your faculty in terms of this event makes a difference?
I thought it was really this emerging sense around faculty, which you often hear in the negative around press, and instead there was a real embrace that faculty are the way in which higher education delivers education, and a lot of people believe technology will replace faculty, and instead there was really a very strong focus on how technology can amplify their work. So the work that we're doing funded by the Kresge Foundation in terms of faculty development through teaching analytics, the work that Michael Crow was talking about at the University of Arizona by looking at how you can link systems of data to really focus interventions on students. The head of Udacity was talking about what you can do when you see large groups of students take online classes. So it was a very interesting, I think, and a new theme about how faculty amplified will really make a difference.
Well, Scott, it seems like the press reports about the technology issues were in two areas. One, as Gail alluded, the analytics, rising conversation about analytics in higher education, the efforts of a number of foundations to support analytic efforts on the part of many institutions. And the second, this faculty contact seems to be that we're moving beyond what used to be the high-tech, high-touch choices to a tech-enabled high-touch. Can you talk about that for a moment?
I think in this event, they did link the two, so it wasn't just the technology. This administration is very enamored of technology efforts to promote change and to increase capacity in higher ed, and I'm not sure they always succeed at both getting excited about technology and the faculty role. So there is some faculty skepticism about the gung-ho enthusiasm for technology. I think it will be essential to carry it off, to talk about it in ways that include the faculty and promote a real faculty role.
Gail, I want to come back to the technology role in terms of individual faculty use. It seems to me that one of the real challenges for many faculty is the absence of evidence that this stuff makes a difference. They see a lot of technology around them. They see significant institutional investments, whether it's on the teaching learning side or the analytics side. But in the context of their individual activities, their classroom, there is still not the kind of FDA-level evidence that says doing this makes a difference in outcomes?
FDA, or Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. One of the things that I've been really excited about in this work I've been doing to really support faculty using an online technology platform is really the difference that it makes. So we've been focused on developmental math and English throughout the country at about 50 different colleges, and we find that it really creates a measurable difference in terms of students getting through the class and passing the class. I find that it is particularly true for adjunct faculty, where we get 15% bumps. So I guess I disagree. There are a lot of individual studies that show the impact of technology. I think the challenge, though, is at the system level, and I think that's what you heard at the summit as well. A lot of look over the systems. How can we scale these things, not just at LaGuardia and two other community colleges, but really throughout all, in my case, 1,200 community colleges, and that's the challenge.
I want to take a step back from the White House to the larger environment in Washington. In his comments at the summit yesterday, President Obama noted that the hundreds of commitments that institutions and organizations made to assist low-income students occurred without any new legislation or without any new federal funding. And yet, congressional politics loom large in the funding and policy conversations about higher education. We have pending the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, and also there's the impact of the November election and the accompanying leadership changes on the new Congress. What's going to be the interplay between the White House efforts at one level and what may or may not happen in Congress at the next? Gail, as you think about this as a president in a public system, you know, where's the lever, or where will things be slowed because of congressional action or inaction?
Well, congressional inaction is sort of the bane of American politics right now, correct? And I do think a lot of the action will happen at the states, and that's why the governors and the states are so important. And in my state, in New York State, Governor Cuomo has been supportive of higher education and really understands it to be the engine of economic development and sort of social viability. And I think you're going to see that as more of the action moves to the states, because we have not seen the kind of federal-level action. Although you do have to say that the Obama administration and the big things on ability to benefit, on gainful employment, on the increase in the Pell Grants, they've gotten that through a pretty tough Congress. So we have seen, federal-level actions as well.
Scott, and over the next 2 years, in the wake of the goals of the leadership summit that was held this week and what the congressional prospects and landscape look like for the next 2 years, are these just going to be separate worlds?
I think they may be largely separate worlds. I think Congress may be receptive to ideas that don't cost anything. But if you look at federal policy that has an impact, say, on whether low-income students graduate, money is part of the picture. If you look at things like the elimination of Summer Pell, which has had a negative impact on completion rates at many community colleges, well, restoring that costs money. My sense is in the current Congress, that's going to be a very difficult argument purely financially, regardless of what people think of a proposal.
Gail, let's go back to the summit. Although not on the agenda as a formal discussion topic, I'm going to have to guess that there must have been some hallway conversation about the impending release of the administration's proposal for college ratings. Was there? I mean, are my inferences correct that there might have been a conversation among you and your colleagues, or informal conversations with administration officials? What are you expecting when the proposal comes forward, which is due sometimes very soon, in the next couple of days or weeks?
I did have the opportunity to talk to, I think it's Under Deputy Secretary Jamie Studley, and there really is, I think, a sense from the administration that they want to be as careful as possible while really moving forward. So there was a lot of conversation about whatever happens will be a draft, if you will, that there will be a lot of openness, a real understanding that, number one, the data are not robust in this area, and number two, that no one wants a metric system that really further hurts places like community colleges that have the least money to serve the most underserved while privileging the elite institutions. That being said, I do feel that there is a strong commitment to moving this forward, and a sense that measuring the effectiveness of higher education across the country is one of the administration's goals.
And Scott, my guess is that as a journalist, you and your colleagues are just waiting for this thing to drop in terms of take looking at the proposals and looking at the reaction. You know, what's going to happen when we see the proposal, and how will it be connected to, for example, the goals of the summit?
Well, the latest we're hearing is that what is going to come out may not be that detailed. And if that's the case, I think we might see more of what we've seen over the last year, which is general criticism, and yet people also saying, you know, I need the details. I think many college leaders have been very worried about exactly how some of these things would be measured and whether they would be fair, whether the right colleges would be compared to the right colleges to avoid apples and oranges situations. And if it doesn't provide enough detail, I think you're going to see skepticism. The irony is, if they release all of the detail, they might actually win over some of the skeptics. But to me, that's the question. Will there be real detail here or not?
Well, we're going to have to wait for the proposal to come forward. Gail Mello from LaGuardia Community College, Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation about the White House Summit. In our second segment today, we're going to talk about fraternity culture. How did we get to where we are today? The recent controversial Rolling Stone article describing a gang rape at a fraternity house at the University of Virginia has been a catalyst for the continuing conversations, both on and off campus, about fraternity culture and sexual violence. Yet there was a time in the early history of American higher education when Greek organizations were formed to serve as campus literary societies and fill other intellectual voids in campus life. Joining us to help us understand the evolution of fraternities and fraternity culture are Nicholas Surrett, Associate Professor at the University of Northern Colorado, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Nick, let me begin with you. If I correctly remember my reading of Frederick Rudolph's classic work, The American College and University, fraternities really began as literary and intellectual societies. They were not really the kind of social clubs that we think of them today.
That's mostly true, yes. There were literary societies on every campus already. Usually every campus had two and sometimes three societies. So fraternities were meant to be something somewhat different than those literary societies. They were smaller. They were meant to be more personal. They provided brotherhood, which they thought was more possible on a smaller scale. But they absolutely did do literary things. So they staged debates, they had libraries, all of that sort of stuff is very much different from what they are doing today.
And yet many would say that, and particularly those who defend fraternity, say that in fact they provide a lot of that brotherhood, they provide some engagement for students that might not be otherwise available. What has changed, and was there a turning point in terms of the dominating social environment of fraternities that you can point to?
Yeah, it seems to me that things changed in the years after the Civil War for a few reasons. The first is that colleges and then universities expanded, and so more and more students came to them, and the literary societies themselves became too large and unwieldy, and so fraternities took over some of the responsibilities that that the literary societies were providing. But it's also the fact that universities and colleges became provided more of the functions that the literary societies and fraternities themselves had provided in the earlier eras. So in the earlier eras, the curriculum was a classical curriculum. There wasn't much room for debating, for reading, other than the classical curriculum. But as universities expanded their curriculum, the functions of fraternities and literary societies in the earlier eras, the university took those things over. The final thing I would point to is that the population of universities and colleges changed. It became a much wealthier population of students. And so the students who were coming were less interested in the sort of intellectual culture of what was happening there or in training for the ministry, and much more interested in both the social aspects of college life and also the fact of getting a BA, which would give them a leg up in a competitive and urbanizing world.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, it would seem that there's this symbiotic relationship between Greek organizations and particularly fraternities and the campuses. Campuses depend on fraternities to provide housing for students, to provide some social services, and yet many would argue, and not just because of recent events, that this relationship comes at significant costs. What's your take on that, the nature of that symbiotic relationship?
Well, I mean, it's important not to generalize because what goes on at some campuses and fraternities isn't uniform. But generally what you've got here is at its worst, you have colleges and universities sort of abdicating their role in providing the services that fraternities provide and also in dealing with the consequences of what goes on in the houses. You have, by wide acknowledgement, serious issues related to drinking and many campuses related to segregation of groups by race or ethnicity or by social class. You have a lot of things. You have sexism. You have and you have rape in some cases. You have harassment in many cases. And because the universities depend on the fraternities for housing and for creating a sense of community for their members, they have arguably looked the other way, or they have very little control in cases where they don't own the houses and control what goes on there.
Nick, let me give you a chance to talk about that symbiotic relationship. I mean, just how intertwined are these issues along the lines that Scott discussed?
I think they're very intertwined. And it really, as Scott said, it really does depend on the college or the university, in part because of issues of ownership of housing and the regulation of fraternities. And so different universities have done it in different ways. But from the late 19th and early 20th century onwards, colleges and universities really came to depend on fraternities, in part because the faculty simply didn't want to do the things that they had traditionally done, which was look after the students, serve in loco parentis, that sort of thing. As they expanded, they just didn't have the housing for them. So fraternities and then increasingly sororities by the 1880s and 1890s stepped in to fill the void. As they did so, though, the universities sort of became entwined in these relationships with them that were not really always of their own making. And they became also not just dependent on the fraternities themselves, but beholden to the alumni of the fraternities who increasingly now, of course, own those houses and feel that they have a say, particularly the national organizations, in the way that the men and women in the fraternities and sororities are regulated on campus. So it's a vexed relationship, I would say, to put it mildly.
So let's stipulate that, in fact, many sororities and many fraternities at many campuses do good in terms of both providing a social center for their students, they're engaged in public service activities, they raise money, they do other things, and yet the public image increasingly is the one of the culture, particularly the fraternities, that deals with drinking, with binge drinking, sexual and violence. And it seems that the recurring theme in the news reports that we've been seeing, even before the Rolling Stone article about the University of Virginia, and the statements of college women who have experienced sexual violence, is that colleges and universities typically do little to address the problem. Women report campus officials and campus police discourage them from filing a campus complaint or pressing legal charges, and that men who have reputations for being sexual predators remain on campus without any sanctions. Are campuses complicit in this issue, in the issue of sexual violence in fraternities, Nick?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. I to me, it just seems undeniable. To the degree that they are not attempting to do something about it, to the degree that they are trying to cover up or hush up the allegations that are made, the very notion that they would attempt to solve, you know, criminal matters on their own campuses instead of directing complainants to the police where they should be going, it is negligent to me, and it seems to me a lot about reputation. If campuses know that they have problems, then it seems difficult to understand how they could not know. They have a responsibility to protect their students, all of their students, and that means their female students as well.
Scott, concurrent with the launch of the Obama administration's initiative on sexual violence on campus, we spent some time on This Week at Inside Higher Ed talking about this with college presidents. One president said, just as Nick suggested, just turn it over to the cops. Campuses should not be involved. You've been watching these issues as a reporter, as a journalist. What's your take on just turning it over to the cops and campuses staying away from these issues in terms of disciplinary action and other initiatives?
Well, that's not actually an option truly for colleges, at least as the law stands right now. A woman who is the victim of sexual violence in a fraternity has the choice to make to involve the cops, and even whether involving the cops or not, that woman may file a complaint with the university about her safety, about the violation of her rights. So while universities can certainly encourage, and many of them haven't historically done this, they can encourage the cops to be involved, they can't prevent a woman from choosing to make this part of their responsibility. The other thing I want to return a little bit to the issue of complicity, and the complicity isn't just on sexual violence. And many campuses, even where, say, only 20-25% of men live in fraternities, fraternities totally dominate the social life of the institution. And I think there is an issue of complicity and responsibility when colleges turn over social life to an unregulated Greek system. It doesn't mean everyone is going to be raped. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to drink to dangerous levels, but they are basically looking the other way at the dangers of those and other things.
Nick, let's talk about campus efforts to address some of these issues in terms of fraternity culture. Even just the public discussion at many institutions to limit or close fraternities or sanctions against fraternities often generates a lot of reaction from often influential alumni. Yet some campuses have successfully terminated Greek organizations or severely limited the role of fraternities or made initiatives to change the culture. Why have some institutions succeeded and others not been successful in these initiatives to change fraternity culture?
I mean, it's an interesting question, and I don't know that there is a definitive answer, but it seems to me that the schools that have been able to do this, so those that have gotten rid of fraternities altogether or really modified them, so Middlebury College, Williams College, Colby College, share some things in common. They are small liberal arts, private liberal arts colleges in New England that are relatively liberal and that have, while they have all three schools, a very long history of fraternities, by the time they chose to do what they were doing, their dependence upon fraternities and sororities, the percentage of students who were in them was not nearly as high as it is at some other schools where the pushback would perhaps be greater. This is not to say that they did not receive pushback. They certainly did, but they were able, in essence, to withstand it for a couple years when alumni were particularly vocal. And some of these schools do have, underground fraternities and sororities, but they're a much lesser presence on these campuses than they have been on others. But I think it has to do with which kinds of schools in the first place have decided to do this.
Well, and Scott, what about the initiative of leaders, campus leaders at other larger and public institutions where there have been issues with fraternity culture, the efforts to change?
I think the difficulty sort of relates to what Nick was talking about. Not only are the institutions that are successful small, but they have the deep enough pockets that they can put real resources into creating new housing, creating new social structures. It's not just a matter of saying you're no longer having fraternities. It's what do you build up in its place? And that is an expensive, time-consuming process to do, in some cases a legal process as well if you're having legal fights. It is much more difficult at large universities. I have been struck, even amid the current debate, while we wrote about one university, University of Mary Washington, that put a Greek plan on hold right now because of the other controversies, even amid all the situations we're going on, I see clips from campuses adding a fraternity, adding a sorority, to take a consistently critical stand, even if you're not going to eliminate them, but say scale them back a little, requires a will that I don't see much of at large universities.
So let's return to the Obama administration's initiative about sexual violence. In the wake of the Rolling Stone article about Virginia, in the wake of other stories, given the administration's initiative, will it have any impact on fraternity culture? Will it have an impact on campus officials in their efforts to address these issues? Nick, let me begin with you.
I hope so, certainly. I don't know that I'm enormously optimistic, though I would like to be. I think part of the problem is just, or two things I would say. One is the way that sexual assault occurs more generally. That is, we know in the wider culture, on universities, pretty much everywhere, it's very difficult for women to come forward, and some men, when they've been sexually assaulted because of, they fear the repercussions and they simply want to sort of move on with their lives. So I don't know that we can necessarily change that or that one initiative will do so. I also think that fraternities as much as we can encourage schools to change, fraternities really do inculcate this sort of spirit of masculinity within their members that encourages them to think about women in particular ways. And one of those ways is sort of sexual, as sexual conquest. And I think until we get to the root of that problem, at least within fraternities, and clearly fraternities are not the only problem with sexual assault on campus, it may be difficult to see a reduction in fraternities' association with rape culture.
Scott, will the administration's initiatives be an effective catalyst to change institutional behavior and, by extension, have some impact on fraternity culture?
Well, they certainly have colleges and universities' attention with this. And I think at most colleges today, there is increased scrutiny for how they handle complaints. And I think that somebody bringing a complaint is less likely to just be shooed away, as happened in the past. At the same time, I think the issue of culture is not something you can easily change via regulation. And to me, one of the most damning parts of the various reports about UVA aren't just how the university is alleged to have responded, but how fellow students respond. Do students take this issue seriously? Do students continue to flock to fraternity parties? Nobody forces them to do so. And so cultural change may follow regulatory change, but they are not the same.
Great. Nick Surrett at University of Northern Colorado, Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation today about fraternity culture. Two, our thanks to Gail Mello, president of LaGuardia Community College, for joining us for the discussion about the White House Summit. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays, and This Week is also available on iTunes. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.